Every year at the holiday called Thanksgiving, thousands of small American children dress up like the pilgrims, grave in tall hats and buckled shoes or starched bonnets and aprons. They proudly reenact the story of the courageous band of settlers who faced a perilous ocean voyage and a harsh Massachusetts winter, all in order to be able to worship freely in their own way. Those who survived feasted with the Native Americans and gave thanks to God. Americans cherish and celebrate that story, but much too rarely reflect on its real meaning, namely that religious liberty is very important to people and it's often very unequally distributed. The dominant majority in England did not have to cross the ocean to worship God in their own way. They established an orthodoxy that favored them and subordinated others. In the England from which the pilgrims fled, people were not equal citizens because their rights were not equally respected by the government under which they lived. The pilgrims were not expelled from England, as the Jews earlier had been expelled, but they were living in a condition of subordination. Something very precious had been withheld from them, and it was to recover that space of both liberty and equality that they crossed the ocean in three small vessels. The lesson of that first Thanksgiving is easy to forget. Indeed, the early settlers themselves soon forgot it, establishing a repressive orthodoxy that subordinated others in turn. People like exclusive clubs that rank them above others. My mother's ancestors came over on the Mayflower, one of those three ships, and some of my relatives were obsessed with triumphal genealogizing as they proudly marshaled all the evidence that they belonged in the exclusive and socially prominent Mayflower Society, and other people did not. The Pilgrims' quest for freedom, centuries later, had become elite Americans' quest for social superiority. Nor was religious toleration in a healthy state among the Pilgrims' descendants. As the exclusion of Jews and Roman Catholics from local private schools, country clubs, and law firms indicated. When later I married a Jew and converted to Judaism, the Pilgrims' descendants did not applaud my decision to live according to my own conscience. So equality and respect for equality are difficult for human beings to sustain, particularly in the area of religion that seems so vital to the health of the state and the salvation of individuals. It's very tempting to think that orthodoxy is a good thing and that those who do not accept it are dangerous subversives. When people are afraid or insecure, when some unusual economic or political threat confronts their nation, respect for equality is even harder to sustain, and the comfort of an orthodoxy even more alluring. It was in 1954, during the panic over the Cold War and the nuclear arms race, that Americans added the words "under God" to our Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, which small school children recite every morning in schools all over the country. So now it became not one nation indivisible with liberty and justice for all, but one nation under God indivisible with liberty and justice for all. The aim was to distinguish God-fearing America from godless communism, but its effect was broader. It was to denigrate atheists, agnostics, members of non-theistic religions such as Buddhism and Confucianism, and all those more standard theists who don't conceive of God as playing favorites among the nations, singling out America for protection no matter what America has actually been doing. All modern democracies are currently in a state of fear, and growing religious diversity is one of the things that inspires that fear. Just as in 19th century America there was a panic about Roman Catholic immigration, and otherwise reasonable people hastened to demonize the entirety of the Roman Catholic faith, saying that Catholics were incompatible with democracy, so too, today, we hear in North America and certainly in Europe the same sweeping and unsubtle arguments about Islam and Muslims. Just as Catholics could be well treated in the U.S. of the 19th and early 20th centuries, only if they pretended to be like everyone else, reciting Protestant prayers in the schools and foregoing anything that drew attention to their religious particularity, so today we hear the same strident demand that Muslims should assimilate, which basically means stopping any practice that draws attention to their difference from others. Of course, the same demand was made of the Jews in Europe of the 18th century, and it was as anti-Semitic as the more violent anti-Semitism of the 19th century, although more polite in tone. Fear of the different has been leading, as it so often does, to a coercive homogeneity, and it is the homogeneity of fear, as we cling for dear life to the familiar, thinking that there alone resides our hope of safety in a perilous world. In this lecture, I'm going to argue that the best antidote to that fear and to the bad behavior that it often inspires lies in renewed commitment to a long tradition of equal respect for conscience that played a formative role in both European and North American institutions, but that's frequently honored more in the breach than in the observance. Renewed commitment to that tradition and to the governmental and legal policies that it entails. What are those policies? I'm going to argue that equal liberty of conscience requires giving citizens ample space to pursue their own conscientious commitments, even when this involves giving them exemptions from some laws that apply to all citizens. Only what's called in American law a compelling state interest should ever be able to justify any diminution of that space. And I'll also argue, second, that liberty of conscience is incompatible with any type of religious establishment, even one that is so gentle and benign as to escape most people's notice. Liberty of conscience is not equal if government announces an orthodoxy, saying that this and not that is the religious view that defines us as a nation. Even if such an orthodoxy is not coercively imposed, it's a statement that creates an in-group and an out-group. Let's look at two cases that introduce these issues vividly. Adele Sherbert worked in a textile factory in the state of South Carolina in the 1950s. All the employers in her town had similar policies for working hours. During a time of economic hardship, after Mrs. Sherbert had been a good employee for many years, the policy changed, and instead of working 5 days a week, employees were now required to work 6 days. And of course, Saturday was the added day because most of the employees in the plant were mainstream Christians. Mrs. Sherbert, however, was a Seventh-day Adventist for whom it is religiously forbidden to work on Saturday. She tried to find similar work elsewhere in the region, but not surprisingly, all the employers had the same policy. There was none that chose to have Saturday as the day off and Sunday as a work day because they too had employees who were mostly mainstream Christians. So Mrs. Sherbert resigned and sought unemployment compensation from the state. She was denied by South Carolina on the grounds that she had refused suitable work. She went to court, arguing that the state had impermissibly impeded her free exercise of religion. In a famous judgment in 1963, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed. They held that benefits could not be made conditional on a violation of a person's religious scruples. This, they said, was just like fining somebody for Saturday worship. In other words, the denial of benefits was a violation of Mrs. Sherbert's equal freedom as a citizen to worship in her own way. So free exercise does not simply mean that no one can come and put Mrs. Sherbert in jail for her non-standard practices. It means as well that the conditions of liberty must be the same for all. The court held that no person may suffer a substantial burden on their free exercise of religion without a compelling state interest, which clearly didn't exist in that case. Second example, the Allegheny County Courthouse stands on public property in downtown Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In the late 1980s, the county set up two holiday season displays. The first, inside the courthouse, consisted of a nativity scene donated by a local Roman Catholic church and labeled to that effect, Placed on the grand staircase of the courthouse in a position of great prominence and honor, the scene had the manger, and then over the manger was an angel holding a sign saying, Gloria in Excelsis Deo. Now, the second display was outside on the courthouse lawn. It consisted of a Hanukkah menorah 18 feet tall, standing next to the city's 45-foot-tall Christmas tree. At the foot of the tree was a message from the mayor of Pittsburgh saying that the whole display was a salute to liberty. Now, in fact, the menorah is a symbol of liberty because Hanukkah commemorates the Maccabees' courageous rebellion against political oppression. Difficult to say whether a Christmas tree represents liberty, but it's such an all-purpose symbol that I guess the mayor can declare that without implausibility. But local residents took both displays to court, claiming that they violated our Establishment Clause. The court obviously considered this a very difficult case. Ultimately, a split court judged that the indoor display did violate the Establishment Clause and the outdoor display did not. And the crucial question they asked was whether each display communicated the message that the county was giving its endorsement to a particular set of religious beliefs and practices, thus threatening equality. Well, the first display did seem to the majority to communicate that sort of endorsement. The religious Christian display stood all alone in a position of special prominence and honor. The outdoor display was different. The fact that more than one religion was honored, even if not very many, and that the theme connecting the tree with the menorah was the theme of liberty, which is a very inclusive theme that could embrace all citizens, whatever their religion or non-religion, meant to at least the majority of the court that the people of Pittsburgh would not be likely, quote, to perceive the combined display of the tree, sign, and menorah as an endorsement or disapproval of their individual religious choices, end quote. We can grant that this was a difficult case to decide, and we can even differ about whether it was rightly decided, while still agreeing about the immense importance of the principle involved. Some religious symbols set up by government threaten the equal standing of citizens in the public realm. They attach the imprimatur of orthodoxy to Christian observance while demoting the beliefs and practices of others. These cases show that making law in a pluralistic democracy is a delicate matter, requiring great sensitivity to a variety of contextual and cultural factors. They also show us that all is not well just because no overt violence occurs between members of one religion and those of another. The U.S. has certainly had its share of outright violence against members of unpopular new religions, Catholics, Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses. But what these recent cases show is that there's also a kind of violence in the subtle assault on equal dignity that consists in being told that you're not a fully equal citizen because of your commitment to your religion. Europe and the U.S. pride ourselves on respect for pluralism and civilized behavior toward minorities, and yet problems like this occur all the time. So I think until we really counter these more subtle threats and develop democracies that are really places of equal respect, especially equal respect for new immigrants whom we don't like and whom we may even fear, we don't have the right to pride ourselves just because there's not very much physical violence. Roger Williams, the great 17th century thinker about religious liberty, who founded, in moving from Britain to America, founded the first colony in which genuine religious liberty and equality obtained, called this subtle violence to conscience soul rape. So we need to think hard about how to develop democracies that are not places of soul rape. I'm going to focus on the U.S. and its legal tradition because I know that tradition best, and I think it is best if one's going to criticize to begin at home. I believe that the nations of Europe have a lot of the same issues to contend with, and in a sense, Europe is at a disadvantage because they've been coping with religious difference for a relatively shorter time and have had less time to develop the political and legal resources necessary to deal with it well. Of course, difference was really present in Europe all along, since the Jews were always around, unless they were expelled. But the Christian majority was so secure that it was possible to avoid lengthy confrontation with the issue until recently. From at least 1640 onward, by contrast, the American colonists, where there was no dominant group, really, knew that they had to learn to live together on terms of mutual respect if they were going to survive at all. And this was actually quite helpful in getting people off their high horse toward genuine cooperation. I'm not going to speak at all today of the legal and political traditions of nations outside the US and Europe, but not because I don't think there's a great deal to be learned from them, as I've always emphasized in the case of India, but rather because I think there's an arrogance abroad in North America and Europe as we impugn the religious fanaticism of others while neglecting the very large planks in our own eyes in the form of a complacent love of homogeneity that's scared of real difference. So now the 17th and 18th century consensus, Roger Williams and James Madison. The tradition I want to examine starts from the idea that every human being has a precious internal faculty for searching for life's ethical basis and its ultimate meaning. This faculty, the founders of the tradition called conscience. But the tradition is much influenced by ancient Greek and Roman Stoicism, and conscience is a close relative of the Stoic idea of the power of moral choice, the directive power. So conscience is in each and every human being, and it is said to be present equally in high and low, male and female, Protestant and Catholic. This conscience is deserving of profound respect and reverence. Even when it's going wrong, it's a major source of our dignity in the world, and it ought to be respected, both by individuals and by laws and institutions. Well, what does it mean to give equal respect to conscience? Here, the ancient Stoic thinkers become quietistic. They think that our moral powers are so invulnerable, so rock hard, they can't be damaged by anything the world does, so it really doesn't matter what laws and institutions do about them. A slave, they say, is always free inside, so the institution doesn't really matter. And even a cruel tyrant can't destroy a person's moral freedom. The 17th century American thinkers who appropriated Stoic ideas in a Protestant context thought differently. The capacity in question is a fragile thing. What the world does to it can stop it from being active, and it can even deform or damage it. Roger Williams, whose great work called The Bloody Tenet of Persecution, published in 1644 in Britain, is a primary foundation of the ideas that I'm going to defend here, compared the first form of damage, that is, being stopped from exercising your power, to imprisonment, and the second form, where it's kind of violated internally, to rape. And he said it was soul rape whenever some people force people to go along with things because it's the orthodoxy. Williams then argues that conscience needs space to unfold itself, to pursue its own way. To respect human beings is therefore to protect that sort of space equally and impartially for each and every one of them. He expresses indignation that someone, quote, that speaks so tenderly for his own, hath yet so little respect, mercy, or pity to the like conscientious persuasions of other men. Are all the thousands of millions of consciences at home and abroad fuel only for a prison, for a whip, for a stake, for a gallows? Are no consciences to breathe the air but such as suit and sample his? Williams has a keen nose for special pleading and unfairness, and he finds it wherever unequal restrictions on liberty of conscience are to be found. Late in his life, he wrote a letter, so he's there in Rhode Island, which had genuine religious equality. And he writes to Massachusetts and Connecticut's governors, where there was still religious establishment, and he says, well, you say that you're in favor of liberty of conscience, but really, what you are worshiping is the great God self. And that means, you know, you want it, but you want it only really for yourselves. Rhode Island, the colony he founded, proclaimed complete and equal liberty for all the people who were unequal elsewhere, Baptists, Quakers, Roman Catholics, Jews, Native Americans, whom Williams particularly befriended and whose property rights he zealously defended, even Muslims, who are actually not there in Rhode Island, so far as I've been able to discover, but whom he always included in his theory. He called them Turks, but that's clearly what he meant. And even more surprisingly, atheists, who were not defended by other 17th century philosophers writing on this topic. In a way that anticipates the arguments of John Rawls in the 20th century, Williams argues that protecting liberty of conscience equally does not mean that public institutions must be devoid of moral content. We can, he argues, agree about and overlap in a shared moral space while disagreeing about the ultimate religious truths to which many people connect these moral truths. Political institutions have a moral nature, but they can express their moral ideas in a way that's separate from a theological or religious grounding, what Rawls so much later calls a freestanding way. So in that very way, they express an ideal of equal respect for all the different groups. It would be a long matter to trace the influence of these ideas on the framers of the U.S. Constitution. Suffice it to say that directly or indirectly, these ideas gradually came to prevail in the colonies, and the main architect of the U.S. Bill of Rights, James Madison, had views very similar to those of Roger Williams. Madison was a particularly keen opponent of all forms of religious establishment on equality grounds, as we'll later see. So, after a lot of wrangling, the text that finally emerged, which we've still got, stated, quote, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." Although at first the provision was binding only on the federal government, amendments added after the Civil War made it binding on state and local government as well. So next section, the modern constitutional consensus, free exercise accommodation. So what does it take to defend religious liberty in a truly even-handed way? One philosophical tradition, beginning with John Locke, who wrote 50 years after Roger Williams, holds that it takes two things only. First, laws that do not penalize religious belief and practice, and second, laws that are neutral, that set up the same conditions for all citizens in matters touching on their religion. For example, says Locke, if it's going to be legal to speak Latin in a school, then it would better be legal to speak Latin in a church. A law that singles out the church and makes it illegal only in church is a form of persecution against Roman Catholics. If it's permitted to immerse yourself in water for the sake of health and recreation, well then, it had better be legal to immerse yourself in water for the sake of baptism. A law that says otherwise is a form of persecution against Baptists. But that's all that fairness to minorities requires. To give them special dispensations of any kind is just unnecessary and wrong. If they don't want to obey some law on account of their religious objections, they'll just have to obey their conscience but take the legal penalty. Locke's position has modern defenders on our Supreme Court, in particular Justice Antonin Scalia, who's prepared to strike down laws that expressly persecute minorities, but who opposes any special accommodation of their practices. For example, he favored striking down an ordinance in the city of Hialeah, Florida, that forbade ritual animal sacrifice. Now, the point was, this was clearly targeting the Santeria worshippers, and its aim was to drive them out of the city of Hialeah. And what Scalia pointed out is it's a very Lockean case, because other forms of animal slaughter, equally painful to the animal, were certainly permitted, but it was only the ritual practices of the Hialeah Santeria worshippers that was prohibited. There was a similar case that went even a little bit further that our Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito heard when he was a judge on the Federal Appeals Court. Muslim police officers in the state of New Jersey were denied the right to wear their beards on the job, and this particular group of Muslims believed that the beard was religiously required. Now, Alito pointed out that the policy, the police regulations, allowed certain people with skin allergies to keep their beards. And he said, if you give this exemption and then you deny it to the religious worshiper, then that, you know, it's another Lockean case. It's a covert form of persecution. So this did go a little further than Scalia because there was no evidence that the regulations were deliberately targeting Muslims. But his claim was that still the lack of neutrality was a problem. For a long American tradition that begins in the 17th century, the Locke-Scalia position is not quite enough. This tradition reasons that in a democracy, laws are always made by the majority. They express majority ideas of convenience, and they will incorporate the religious preference of the majority. In Christian nations, we just expect that Sunday will be the day off from work because the majority wants to rest on a Sunday. Such laws, even if they don't involve any hostility to religious minorities, are apt to be heedless, not noticing the special burdens that minorities have to face. Already before the War of Independence, the colonists had become used to such problems. Quakers refused to take off their hats in court, although the law required that. Jews refused to give testimony in court on a Saturday when they were summoned to court. Both Quakers and Mennonites refused required military service. The position that emerged was one that favored specially tailored exemptions called accommodations in those cases. In a famous letter to the Quakers written shortly after independence, our first president, George Washington, said, quote, "I assure you very explicitly that in my opinion, the conscientious scruples of all men should be treated with great delicacy and tenderness. And it is my wish and desire that the laws may always be as extensively accommodated to them as a due regard for the protection and essential interests of the nation may justify and permit," end quote. Well, what that was about was military service, and he did not require the Quakers to perform military service, and he also did not ask them, as Locke would have, to pay a legal penalty. Similarly, Jews were not required to appear in court on a Saturday, and they were not fined either. Shortly after independence, in a memorable early court decision, a Roman Catholic priest was allowed to refuse to answer questions posed to him when he was under oath in a criminal case when he said that his information about the return of the stolen property came to him in the confessional. The judge, who was a Protestant, reasoned that to require a priest to divulge this information or to send him to jail for contempt of court for not divulging it would impose a very heavy burden on all Roman Catholics and would in effect abolish the sacrament of the confessional. It was on account of this tradition that Adele Sherbert got her unemployment compensation. The Supreme Court reasoned that imposing such an unequal burden could be done only if the state could show a compelling interest in the uniformity in question, for example, by showing that peace and safety were at stake. And that clearly wasn't the case here. Just a little bit more administrative work. During the Vietnam War era, moreover, the traditional idea of religiously grounded accommodation was extended to include many people whose conscientious refusal to fight did not stem from anything like a traditional religious belief or practice, but simply from their own personal form of conscientious searching. In 1990, this tradition received a blow when a majority of the Supreme Court, influenced by the very strong opinions of Justice Scalia, reverted to the Lockean position in a case concerning Native American drug use, the use of peyote, a drug illegal under state law, in the sacred ceremonies of an Oregon tribe. Justice Scalia said we would have chaos if we allowed exemptions to general laws, and he carried the day. The public was outraged, so 2 years later there was a law called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that was passed by Congress and signed into law by President Clinton that restored the more protective tradition through legislation. The Supreme Court then struck that law down on the ground that it exceeded Congress's power. Nonetheless, parts of the law remain in force. It's in force as applied to acts of the federal government. And by now, Congress has righted the most egregious imbalances by legalizing the sacramental use of peyote. Many states, moreover, have passed protective legislation of their own that restores the space for accommodations or exemptions. By now, even the Supreme Court seems to be moving back on track. In a recent decision, they gave a small Brazilian sect that had only 132 members the right to use a hallucinogenic drug that Congress had not legalized because this sect didn't have the political power of the Native Americans, and they gave them the right to use that hallucinogen called huasca in their ceremonies. In that same case, during oral argument, Justice Scalia announced that we can make exemptions for religious minorities without courting anarchy, something that seems to be a big concession and a sign, perhaps, that he's going over to the tradition he had previously disparaged. Europe today is in most respects Lockean. Since the 18th century, the dominant tradition has always been one of religious freedom combined with uniformity and assimilation. As I'll discuss later, the French school dress code imposes special burdens on minorities and would almost certainly be unconstitutional under the tradition that I've favored. So too would be the recent British policy that denied a Muslim girl an exemption from her school's dress code. The tradition says that to live with others on a term of fully equal respect means allowing them plenty of space to live the way their own conscience dictates, even when that seems pretty strange to the majority and requires not going along with majority rules. Well, I think that there's something to be looked into there, and that it would be good to have a dialogue about this and to contemplate that. Next section, the modern constitutional consensus, non-establishment with equal respect. As I've said, the liberty of conscience tradition quickly became skeptical of any type of religious establishment on the grounds that it's soul rape to impose any kind of uniformity on the striving individual conscience. Establishments were worse when they threatened liberty, penalizing people for non-orthodox worship, or forcing them to affirm sentiments they might not believe, or attaching conditions of orthodoxy to a person's ability to hold political office. All these things were once common. It was quickly understood, however, that even an apparently benign establishment fostered inequality by simply making a statement that government endorses a particular brand of religion. This endorsement is inevitably also a disendorsement, creating an in-group and an out-group. As James Madison said, all men are to be considered as entering into society on equal conditions. And, he argued, even a non-coercive establishment violates that equality. Now, Madison was speaking in 1785 in opposition to a very mild proposal, and this was the proposal, to tax all citizens of Virginia for the support of the established Anglican Church. But people who were not Anglicans could instead apply the tax payments to their own church. People who didn't really like any of those churches could divert it to a fund for teachers of religion, and Quakers and Mennonites were exempted altogether. So it was really a very kind of sympathetic law. Nonetheless, Madison thought that the bare announcement that the Anglican Church was the official church and the default option created ranks and orders of citizens. In 1984, discussing our constitutional ban on religious establishment, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor recapitulated the long Madisonian tradition as follows. The Establishment Clause prohibits government from making adherence to a religion relevant in any way to a person's standing in the political community. Endorsement sends a message to non-adherents that they are outsiders, not full members of the political community, and an accompanying message to adherents that they are insiders, favored members of the political community. According to the helpful analysis that she then develops, the right question to ask of any potentially problematic policy is the following one. Would an objective observer, acquainted with all the relevant historical and contextual facts, view the policy in question as one that makes a public statement of endorsement or disapproval, sending a message of inequality? Now, with that idea in mind, I'm going to look very briefly at three areas of current controversy: school prayer, public displays, and government funding of religious schools. And in each case. I'll just pick one case as representative of the long tradition. So public schools and school prayer. All American public schools used to include a lot of religious observance, prayer, Bible reading, and so on. Invariably, these observances were Protestant in nature, and people didn't even notice how unfair they were to Roman Catholics. Bible readings were from the King James Version of the Bible. The Ten Commandments were recited in their Protestant version, which Catholics do not accept, and so on. When Catholics protested, things did not go well. Catholic children were often beaten for refusing to say the Protestant version of the Ten Commandments. By the mid-20th century, these barbarisms had been rejected, and people sometimes even allowed a choice among versions of the Bible, but there was still an implicit rejection of anything non-Christian. In a small town in Pennsylvania, and it was actually right next door to where I was going to public school at that time, law required a Bible reading at the start of the school day. A student would be chosen to lead it each day, and it would be broadcast to all classrooms in the school on the public address system. 16-year-old Ellery Shemp, a very bright and thoughtful young man who's now a distinguished research physicist, thought about this custom, and he thought it was probably wrong and even unconstitutional. He decided to challenge it. So on his day to lead the Bible reading, he brought in a copy of the Quran and read from that. Now, this was before there were any Muslims in that school district at all, and no one was really thinking about them, but that was just the point that he was trying to make, that there was an exclusion. And Shemp himself was a Unitarian, and he still is. He was just making a point about the statement that the school's policy made. Immediately, the school principal called Shemp to his office and subjected him to disciplinary action. And the same principal then wrote to all the colleges and universities that Shemp had applied to, telling them that they should not accept him because he was a troublemaker. And then when only one, that is Tufts University, did accept him, and this is, you know, quite interesting that all the others knuckled under, he then called the admissions office at Tufts and said, "Do you know what you're doing accepting this troublemaker?" And so, but meanwhile, and he did go to Tufts, he graduated in 3 years, and then he went to graduate school at Brown, thereby returning to Rhode Island, the cradle of liberty. But anyway, back to age 16, Shemp went home, and he borrowed his father's typewriter, and he typed a letter to the American Civil Liberties Union, enclosing $10 that he'd saved up from his allowance, and asked them to take his case. This is an interesting case because usually the child is just the proxy for the parents' desire to challenge the law. But in this case, the parents were happy for him to do it, but he was the instigator. Eventually, the case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Pennsylvania school law that mandated Bible reading every day was declared unconstitutional in 1963. I think it's not hard to see the wisdom in that decision. And it's a very good thing, too, that small children from non-standard religions or with no religion don't have to face this coercive pressure, or for that matter, that even those from the standard religion don't get lulled into thinking that theirs is the only religion and the best religion and so on. Hinduism and Buddhism are the two fastest-growing religions in the U.S., and the custom Shemp challenged made a strong statement that children from these religions, as well as Islam, were not fully equal. Public displays, next. Well, I've already talked about that in talking about the Christmas tree and the menorah, but let me mention now another one that came up a few years ago that was very, very divisive. The Ten Commandments seemed to many Americans a very important sign of Judeo-Christian religious traditions that many Americans cherish. At one extreme, nobody much, and I think almost nobody, thinks it would be good to require affirmation of the Ten Commandments as a condition of holding political office, although, in fact, that once was done in several states. At the other extreme, nobody thinks it objectionable that the building in which the U.S. Supreme Court sits has on its front a statue of Moses holding the Ten Commandments, but along with lots of other statues, sculptures of great lawgivers through history, from many different religions. So the point is that that one doesn't give special prominence to any particular religion. The connecting theme is clearly just law and its place in history. So on those extremes, there's agreement, but in the middle, there's a lot of room for disagreement. The two cases that recently came before the Supreme Court were as follows. In McCreary County, Kentucky, displays of the Ten Commandments were required by law in all public schools and in all courthouses. The legislature announced that its purpose was to affirm America's Judeo-Christian heritage. When the displays were challenged by lower courts, they grudgingly added some other parts to the display, like the Declaration of Independence and so on. And then they said, oh, well, the point is to show the influence of the Ten Commandments on America's legal history. And I think that's really quite an implausible claim, because the commandments are either so sectarian that they certainly don't suggest a direction for law in a pluralistic society, or, in the case of the latter group, they're so general, as in thou shalt not kill, that they suggest no specific direction for law that could be useful. Meanwhile, so here's the other case. The state of Texas has, for 40 years, had on the grounds of its state house a large monument that includes the whole text of the Ten Commandments, actually in a version prepared by an interreligious committee of Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. So that itself was interesting. And it was donated by a private organization, and it's among many other monuments on the State House grounds donated by other private organizations that commemorate various things the donors want to commemorate, including the heroes of the Alamo, fallen Confederate soldiers, voluntary firemen, the Texas Rangers, Texas Cowboys, Texas Children, Texas Pioneer Women, Pearl Harbor veterans, the Statue of Liberty, Korean War veterans, World War I veterans, disabled veterans, Texas peace officers, and a few others. Well, in separate cases, both of these displays had been found unconstitutional by lower courts, and so the Supreme Court had to sort things out. Inevitably and rightly, the analysis turned on issues of endorsement and equality. The Kentucky displays were struck down because the law seemed to convey the message that Judeo-Christian religion is preferred and other sources of value and meaning are dispreferred. Well, the Texas display was upheld by a very narrow margin. And that case, I think, like the Pittsburgh one, is a difficult one because the analysis rightly turns on subtle issues of context and perception. If you look at the Supreme Court reporter, it's the only case where there are pictures and diagrams showing, you know, where each monument is, did you have to pass the Ten Commandments to get in the front door of the State House, etc. Well, I think it was rightly decided, but one could certainly argue both sides. What's important is to see how different it is from the Kentucky case. The state is simply allowing different private groups to make their own statements, and it's not itself taking sides. So Justice O'Connor's endorsement test, the modern version of Madison's earlier insights, gives good guidance and asks the right questions. Finally, government aid to religious schools. Tax money may not advance a particular religion over other religions, and also may not advance religion as a whole over non-religion. That's pretty generally agreed. But it's also clear, or should be, that it would be unfair for the state to treat religion with special disfavor. Given that the modern administrative state is so vast, entering into so many aspects of citizens' daily lives, it's very difficult to withhold all government aid from religion without giving it horrible disadvantages. Suppose that churches didn't have access to the public water supply or the sewer system. Suppose that the fire department would not put out a fire in a burning church on the grounds that government money can't be spent on the church. Well, these things look profoundly wrong, and no one is even suggesting that that's the way they should be. Why? Because we see that equality is at stake. If these policies were adopted, the life, health, and safety of religious people would be at unequal risk, and the state would be making a statement that their safety is less important than that of the non-religious. So that's the agreement at one end of the spectrum. At the other end, most people also agree that it would be terribly wrong if the state of Texas, let's say, declared that it would only give tax money to Christian schools. Once again, however, there's a lot of ground in the middle, and it has caused bitter division in America, particularly about various forms of public aid to religious schools, largely because most of the religious schools in America are Catholic schools, and there's still a lot of anti-Catholicism in America. Well, there are many cases involved here, but most controversial of all are various so-called voucher programs, which give parents in a failing public school district, under certain special circumstances, some cash that they could use to pay their child's enrollment in a private or religious school if they so choose. These policies are problematic because they threaten to undermine the public schools. On the other hand, if they're confined to special cases where the schools have already been declared to be in a specially disastrous state, as was the case in the Supreme Court case that came up in 2002 in the city of Cleveland, well, then I think those policies probably are acceptable. Here, as before, what's important to see is the importance of the equality analysis. So we have to always ask whether a given form of aid expresses government favor for a religion or a particular religion, or whether, by contrast, a given refusal of aid expresses actual disfavor for religion. So far in this lecture, I have not used the words separation of church and state, so often used in this connection. My avoidance of these words is deliberate. This slogan, in fact, was not a part of our original constitutional tradition. It's not in the Constitution. None of the framers used it. They preferred the language of liberty and equality. The slogan actually arose in the mid-19th century during a time of intense anti-Catholicism, and it expressed people's fear that the Catholic Church was going to take over America's institutions. Now, of course, to some extent, the words can rise above that tawdry history. And in the mouths of many thoughtful liberals, they do express admirable values of liberty and equality. But the idea of separation doesn't direct thought well. Total separation of church from state, if we think of it literally, is both impossible and undesirable. And as I say, we don't want to deny the churches the aid of the fire department and the police and so on. We also don't want to deny priests and ministers the right to run for public office, although that was once a policy that some people held. How much separation is a good thing and how much is a bad thing? That's the question we always have to ask. And I think we can answer it well only with recourse to more fundamental values, namely those of equal standing in the political community and equal liberty. Well, once again, I think this area of U.S. thought is a useful one for Europe to ponder. Many issues that are emerging only now in Europe, such as the crucifix in Italian public schools, the question whether the EU Constitution should or shouldn't mention the word Christian and so on, have been pondered thoroughly in this tradition, and so it at least offers something to argue with and to reflect about. Finally, just to end with the attack on the tradition of liberty of conscience. The tradition I've praised has, of course, many enemies, but we can reduce them all to two, both rather common in modern liberal democracies, and it's with these assailants that I want to end. Neither is a double-dyed villain, but both, I believe, fail to understand something essential about what equal respect for persons requires. The first opponent I'll call the establishmentarian. This person thinks that good order and public safety require a public commitment to a religious orthodoxy, a dominant religious tradition. Life with so many religions is too chaotic, too fraught, unless we can state clearly that this is who we are as a nation. This is our creed, our identity, our tradition. Anyone who wants to live in peace among us has to acknowledge this and assimilate to it. Now, of course, the view I defend requires a nation to take a moral stand, saying this is who we are. Our freestanding political principles have a moral content, prominently including the idea of equal respect for persons. But the establishmentarian says that's not enough. We must go further. We must say this is the primary religious tradition of our community. Establishmentarians are sometimes overtly malign. Then, thus, in 17th century America, the Puritans in Massachusetts imprisoned or exiled people whose beliefs and practices didn't suit the dominant norm. In 19th century America, as I said, little Catholic children were beaten if they wouldn't recite the Protestant version of the commandments. Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses were assaulted and killed in large numbers. Today, however, The malign sort of establishmentarianism is reasonably unpopular in Europe and North America, and a more cozy, apparently benign form has taken its place, the form that says, we need only be clear about who we primarily and centrally are, and then the different can live in peace among us. And that, of course, is the view that I've been targeting all through the lecture. It is a view held by many Americans and many Europeans. In America, it's the view of much of the religious right of former President Bush on the Supreme Court of Justices Scalia and Thomas. Justice Scalia said openly in his stinging dissent in the Kentucky Ten Commandments case that ours is basically a monotheistic nation and that it's perfectly all right and indeed urgently important for public monuments and public ceremonies to affirm the truth of monotheism, under which, interestingly, he included Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. But then he quickly said, oh, but it's all right to disfavor Hinduism, Buddhism, and, of course, atheism and agnosticism. The slightly more subtle view of the late Chief Justice William Rehnquist was that it was never right to favor a particular religion or group of religions, but it would be a very good thing, and it was permissible constitutionally, he said, to favor religion in general over non-religion. That view is only apparently better because it allows agnostics and atheists to be cast as second-class citizens. What's wrong with this view is it doesn't treat people as equals. It asks some to subordinate their consciences to those of others. Even a benign establishmentarianism can have quite far-reaching effects disadvantageous to minorities. It can support policies that use taxpayer money to fund schools of only a particular religious sort, that allow religious tests for public office, and so on. But even when an establishment doesn't do that, like the one in Virginia that Madison was opposed to, well, still, as Madison said, such a policy, just by announcing an official state religion, tells minorities that they don't enter the public square on equal conditions. It asks them to live on genial terms of permanent second-class citizenship. Now, it's easy for Americans to frown on this opponent because they associate these views with the religious right, and American intellectuals are accustomed to think of the people of the religious right as very different from themselves and not very bright. It's less easy for them to frown on my second opponent, who's found mostly on the left. This opponent I'll call the anti-religionist. This position, as you'll see, is the flip side of Rehnquist's position. So Rehnquist says it's okay to prefer religion over non-religion. The anti-religionist says that it's fine to disfavor religion and prefer non-religion. So the anti-religionist thinks that religion in general should be disfavored in the public square, not for reasons of equality or liberty, but because he or she thinks religion, a divisive force, embarrassing, a relic of a pre-scientific era, in short, a source of nothing but trouble. We can best build lasting democracies if we discourage religion and build on secular scientific rationality. Of course, such people don't want to repress religion or even to penalize religious people, but they think we should certainly discourage it in public ceremonies, public schools, and so on, and there's certainly no reason to bend over backwards to give it space to unfold itself. Anti-religionism is official policy in France, though in a form that doesn't valorize science, as more recent forms tend to do. It's the semi-official public creed of post-Nehruvian India, where one would hardly find any progressive intellectuals, whether Hindu, Muslim, or Christian, who would not speak slightingly about religion in much the way that Nehru so often did, treating it as a relic of the past that holds India back from her greatest achievements. And it was the view of the great American philosopher and educator John Dewey, who favored a kind of humanist public creed that was non-religious and whose influence played a key role in the drive to withhold state funding from religious schools. It's a view that many intellectuals express with passion today. What's wrong with anti-religionism? Well, the first thing that has been wrong with most actual versions of it is that it's likely to be especially harsh toward minority religion. The religion of the majority doesn't look particularly religious because it's so woven into dominant laws and customs that it doesn't stand out. Dewey had few objections to Protestantism. because Protestants went to the public schools. Well, after all, why shouldn't they? They were basically Protestant schools. Protestants didn't make a fuss about wanting a different version of the Ten Commandments. After all, the one that was ubiquitous was already their version. Protestants didn't ask for special dispensation regarding days of work. After all, they already had Sunday off. So Protestants could be treated as if they were non-religious already. They fit in, and they didn't ask for anything on religious grounds. Anti-Catholics, and this included Dewey and his students, liked to add that Protestantism shares the anti-religionist commitment to the autonomy of each person's reason. So even the religious aspect of Protestantism could be seen as a slightly outdated form of non-religion. Catholics were another matter. They had these outlandish hierarchies, these nuns and priests in strange clothing, these garish ceremonials, and they made a fuss about everything, wanting their own Bible, their own Ten Commandments, and even their own schools. So Dewey and his graduate students conducted studies of Catholic communities, immigrant communities, and they came back writing that Catholics are submissive, herd-like, and incapable of democracy. It was one of Dewey's graduate students, Paul Blanchard, who became the editor of The Nation, and he was brother of the famous philosopher Brand Blanchard. But as the editor of The Nation, which is a leading left-wing magazine in America, he wrote the extremely popular and influential book, American Freedom and Catholic Power, which told Americans that the power of the Catholic Church was as great a threat to American values as global communism. This book sold 500,000 copies, was endorsed by Eleanor Roosevelt. It was the darling of left-wing intellectuals. So the first problem with anti-religionism is that anti-religionists often don't play fair, and anyone who wants to look different gets worse treatment than an equally religious person who fits in, something that has meant that anti-religionism has typically been quite unfair to Jews and Muslims, and is so in France today. Jewish yarmulkes and Muslim headscarves are forbidden in schools, along with large Christian crosses, but it's too rarely mentioned that this is an utterly unequal burden because Jewish men and Muslim women regard the forbidden articles of dress as religiously obligatory, while Christianity does not oblige anyone to wear large crosses. The second problem with anti-religionism is that it's likely to be stingy with accommodations. Because it thinks religion is fundamentally not a good thing and not that important, it's not likely to go out of its way to give people dispensations from laws of general applicability on grounds of conscience. Drug laws, laws about work days, all of these will be arranged to suit the convenience of the modern administrative state. If the anti-religionist thinks a particular war wrong, well, then she may oppose that war, but she's not going to be interested in granting an exemption to military conscription on grounds of conscience. Third and most basic, even a fair anti-religionism is not compatible with a thoroughgoing commitment to equal respect. Anti-religionism says, here we are, the enlightened ones. Philosopher Daniel Dennett, in a piece in the New York Times, called himself and his fellow anti-religionists, the brights. It was called the bright stuff. And, well, the idea is we brights see more clearly than you, you know, whatever dummies or whatever the opposite of that is over there. I think this is not a good basis for democracy. It's not a good stance to take towards one's fellow citizens in a world full of mystery and complexity, where it's a very good bet that nobody, not Dan Dennett either, has the ultimate solution to questions about the meaning of life and death that have plagued humanity ever since humanity began to exist. If scientific anti-religionists think they do have the answer in the form, for example, of a reductive physiological account of the life and death of organisms, we could protest that this is an answer so drained of mystery and genuine curiosity that it's this answer, not the tradition of the religions, that demeans humanity and compromises the project of building a rich, multifaceted state based on respect for humanity. The framers of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights agreed not to base the Declaration on any specific religious or ethical doctrine, but they did need to agree, they said, on a moral view of human dignity that made human beings not mere bundles of matter, not mere objects to be used for the ends of efficiency. Nehru and John Dewey, of course, were not the scoffing sort of anti-religionist, and it may be insulting to them even to mention them together with Dennett, but then they should have understood that the complex mysteries of human life call forth many different types of searching from the internal capacity of conscience in many different human beings, some forms being non-religious and some forms being religious, and that the capacity with which people conduct this search is worthy of the greatest respect and a fully equal respect, whether the form the search takes is religious or non-religious. On the night before his death, Nehru had copied out, and it was left on his night table, in his own handwriting, these lines from the poet Robert Frost: "The woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep." That a man with such profound sensitivity to the depths of the human conscience and its strivings should so often have denigrated the religious form this striving took in the vast majority of his countrymen is a sad fact, one to be explained, perhaps, by the strange confluence of elitism and Marxism in Nehru's education. In any case, we should follow Nehru's poetic soul and not his cramped vision of what he called the masses, as we try to cultivate the humanity in each of us that will sustain our own developing commitment to democracy. Conscience is a delicate and vulnerable thing. It needs support from laws and institutions. Because it's worthy of equal respect, it's worthy of equal support. An approach to political principles based on the idea of equal respect for persons should learn from the tradition I've described, and reject both establishmentarianism and anti-religionism in order to be fully respectful and fully fair to all human beings. Thank you.
Samatha, I would like to thank you for this great and enlightening lecture you gave to us. Martha Nussbaum agreed to allow a couple of questions and comments on her lecture, and I think we have 20 minutes left. So we're supposed to have two microphones in the room. Yeah. So just raise your hands and go ahead. Maybe I should add for the fellows of the summer school, we'll have time to come back on this topic and discuss it again in tomorrow's class. So don't worry, you will have time to comment on it. Okay, so go ahead, please.
I've got a question about your take on public display. I'm up here.
There you are. Yeah.
From what you describe, I would see myself as a non... What did you say? Like a non...
Anti-religionist,
right. And from what I know, in the U.S. there's no law that requires presidents or any judges to be sworn in on a Bible. And I would, because the office of the president of the United States is such a prominent person and such an important office in the world, in my opinion, I would deny him the right to choose even a Bible. But because, as far as I know, all presidents, except Kennedy, have been white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, all chose to be sworn in on the Bible.
No, the current one isn't white. He may be he's not Anglo-Saxon.
Okay, he's still an Anglo-Saxon Protestant in a way. So I would like to hear your take on why shouldn't...
Well, it's a good question. I mean, really, there are a lot of things that take place that really shouldn't take place because they express... I mean, I don't think you have to be an anti-religionist at all to be troubled by that because it does seem to express favor for religion. Now, early on, both Jefferson and Madison were troubled by things of that ilk. They both thought the president shouldn't make a Thanksgiving proclamation that mentioned God. Madison came to that view late. He did it while he was president, and then later he said he regretted it. So there are a lot of things that, you know, and that have been around for a long time. And then the question is there a point at which we can say, well, it's just part of our history and we shouldn't make a fuss about it? Now, what the Supreme Court has said, and this was Justice O'Connor, is that if it, we can look for certain signs to see whether something is of that sort and therefore not be too troubled about it from the Establishment Clause point of view. First of all, does it have, has it been around for a long time? Well, of course, in America, that doesn't mean much because it's a young country, but pretty long. Second, does it have minimal religious content? Third, does it, or doesn't it, ask anyone else to perform an act of worship? Now, those seem to me to be useful questions to ask. And if you ask those questions of, let's say, the phrase, "In God We Trust" on America's currency, well, I mean, even though it's only been around since just after the Civil War, and it did come up in this odd way that a Baptist minister wrote to the Secretary of the Treasury and said he thought the Civil War was caused because God was angry that he wasn't mentioned on our money. I mean, it's, even then, it's been around for a pretty long time, and it, you know, it certainly doesn't require you to perform an act of worship, and it has minimal religious content. Now, O'Connor tried to apply that to the defense of the words "under God" and the Pledge of Allegiance, and there I think she just went off the track completely. I mean, by her own test, those words in the pledge are profoundly unconstitutional. Swearing the oath on the Bible is one of those funny things because it's just a voluntary act on the part of the president. And it's like the Thanksgiving Proclamation. And, you know, I think with Jefferson and Madison, president shouldn't do that because you want to give the impression that you are president of everyone. Now, what Obama actually did was to make very sure that in other aspects of the ceremony and other remarks he made, he included non-religion and non-Christian religion. So that's the way he tried to get the balance right. And so the sense he wanted to convey was that he was expressing his personal faith, but he was showing respect for the faith of other people. But I'm not convinced because I think the president is not equal, and he's always in a ceremonial role. So he can't do anything that's merely personal. So I agree with you that that's troubling. I also think it's very troubling that the U.S. Senate always opens with a prayer, and it's up until very recently, it's always been a Christian prayer and usually Protestant. Now they've begun to make it more pluralistic. But when the first Hindu prayer was introduced, oh, there were people in the gallery who started demonstrating and yelling. And so, you know, these things are still very controversial. And I guess it would be better, to just do away with that custom. No one really gets much out of the prayers anyway. And so, I entirely agree with you, and I don't think that's an anti-religionist position at all. It's a sort of equality position.
Hello. Thank you for being here. The exemptions that religious people may get, for example, of getting drafted or something like that, there is no equivalent for non-religious people, even though they might hold the conviction that they obey somehow a natural law or other universal principles that are transcendent as well. Do you think that is a just...
Do you think it's
unjust or just to do that?
Well, you know, that's the Achilles heel of this accommodationist position because it's hard to think of how to extend it to all forms of committed searching without going through what would be an inquiry that courts are ill-suited to conduct into people's sincerity, the nature of their individual beliefs, and so on. And what has emerged is that they've attempted to do that in the military conscription case. So the two cases where individuals who didn't declare a religion were exempted from the draft, and of course that laid the way for lots of other people to get the same exemption, were cases where they were able to articulate a creed in quite an extensive way, and then the court said, well, you know, this seems to play the same role in that person's life as a standard religion plays in the life of the religious believer. So they reasoned by analogy that this was religion-like enough. Now, you see what that does is give privileges to the educated and the articulate, because both Seeger and Welsh were, you know, very thoughtful. They had laid out their views with great care. And under the religion exemption, you don't have to be educated at all. You just have to be a member of that religion. So it was still quite unequal in that way. And they've never dared to do that with drugs. Now, you can see why, right? Because anyone will come and tell a story. And in fact, there are so many even bogus religions that have been made up. Like, there's one called, well, I can't even remember the name of it, but they said that they believed that the biblical injunction to eat the herbs of the field meant to use marijuana, and they interpreted it that way. Oh, no, it was called the Church of the Great Boo-Hoo for some reason. Anyway, you know, so that it's hard enough when you limit it to religion to decide what's a genuine and what's a bogus claim. I think the right solution would just be do away with the drug laws, but that's not a solution that America is prepared to take. And so one scholar, Kent Greenewalt, says he thinks that's okay. They should be very liberal with respect to the military because it's such a burden to put on somebody to make them kill, and they should be tougher with the drug laws. And that's intellectually very unsatisfactory, but it might be the right policy in practice. I think it's the strongest case against accommodation. When people object to accommodation, they object to many things, but I think the strongest argument you could make is that religious people get a break and equally sincere non-religious people don't get the same break. Now, so it looks to me like we have two alternatives only, the Lockean position and then the accommodationist position that's stretched as much as we can stretch it to squeeze in conscientious objectors of other types, but it's never going to be perfect. I favor that one simply because of the history, because the history of persecution of people on group membership basis is such a huge and ugly feature of our history. And, you know, people who have an individual set of beliefs more rarely come in for that kind of persecution because people don't know about it and so on. And so I think to save ourselves from a lot of persecution, we probably ought to favor the slightly unfair but stretched as much as we can stretch it accommodationist position. But you've identified just the weak point.
Thank you very much for your talk. Considering that there can be very deep conflicts between religious forms of life and other forms of life, I'm thinking of what Kierkegaard has written. I wonder whether you have a general conception of where to draw the line, where to draw the line for legal exceptions. Because considering an example from Great Britain where it is discussed to introduce Sharia law for certain cases of civil law, and even introduce Sharia courts. So do you have any general concept of where to draw the line?
That's yeah. Well, I do. I mean, I guess there are two things. I mean, as a teacher of American law, I have to ask what materials courts have to work with and what they could legally and permissibly do with those materials. But then as a philosopher, I also have a normative position. So anyway, they're close. And basically, so you see that the idea is you can't impose a substantial burden without a compelling state interest. Now, that idea of compelling state interest has never been exhaustively defined. It's been defined only by example. Peace and safety are obvious, but sometimes they allow other interests, public health, and so on. I have defended, as a philosopher, the position that you could use the capabilities that are on my list as compelling state interests. In other words, if one of those capabilities is threatened, then there would be justification in limiting religious freedom. Now, that would be limiting, that would apply to people who inflict these things on others. It wouldn't necessarily apply to what people may do to themselves. I think that's a question about which really courts should not have very much to say. So I think courts should bend over backwards not to assume that what Mill calls self-regarding activity, that is activity that involves only the interest of those who consent, poses a danger to the public. There was an interesting case involving a religion that handles poisonous snakes, and courts went back and forth on that in a very interesting way because their instinct, you could see, was all in favor of saying this is dangerous and it scares us and we don't want to allow it. But then they thought, well, you know, these people have all consented to the risk and we're satisfied that they keep children out of it and there's no non-consenting, no one but consenting adults. And so, you know, then they decided in the end that those safety precautions had not been enough for the children. So in the end, they withdrew that. But that's the right kind of approach, I think, to ask, are they inflicting on someone who doesn't consent a risk to their health and safety? So, for example, when Jehovah's Witness parents want to refuse on behalf of their children a life-saving blood transfusion, the courts deny them the right to do that. And when adults want to do it, well, they can do it. And so I think those are signs that the U.S. tradition, although it's piecemeal, is sort of close to my idea that we take certain central capabilities and we regard those as quite important. And, you know, by contrast, when there was a case where the Amish parents wanted to keep their children out of age, they wanted them to be made to leave school at age 14, what in the end the court said was they didn't think that there was a compelling interest that the state had in those two particular years of education. And whether that was right or wrong depends quite a lot on what you think children learn at that age. If you think that that's a crucial time for developing a sense of options to exit from a community and so on, then maybe that case was wrongly decided, because that would be a central capability in my view. But if you think, as I tend to, that those years are years of peer pressure, dating, and you know that the crucial values are learned earlier or not at all, then maybe it's rightly decided. So anyway, that's the kind of analysis that I would go through. That is, are these people inflicting on people who don't consent anything that involves violation of a central capability?
Thank you very much for your lecture. I have a question concerning what I would consider the quite unequal moral content of positive religions. I don't think all religions are equal in their moral contents. They were founded or grew up under different circumstances, in different periods of human history, in different regions. Now, a lot of them, of quite unequal age, coexist in our increasingly pluralistic Western societies. How would you assess the areas of equality or areas of inequality from your point of view? I mean, you introduced the concept of capabilities just now, and maybe I would appreciate your elaboration.
Well, you know, I actually think if you do it by denomination, there's nothing very interesting to be said, because I think the differences are huge between progressive, dynamic people and more conservative people within a given denomination. So that if you take an issue like the issue of same-sex marriage, for example, the breakdown is not between this denomination and that denomination. With the exception of the Mormons, who are wholeheartedly against, it's an internal dispute within each and every denomination. And so I once organized a conference about this, which brought together liberals and conservatives from each of the four major American denominations. It became perfectly plain that they even use the same arguments, you know, and the conservatives have made common cause around this, and the liberals too. And so religion is typically a dynamic phenomenon, and people who aren't satisfied with the more traditional form will go and create their own form. And, of course, some forms have dynamism and individualism built into them more than others. I'm a Reform Jew, and Reform Judaism has no dogmas because it's the nature of the religion that each person's conscience is the arbiter of what's correct. But, you know, even so, they still have platforms, and they say, well, if you don't, the minimum wage is something that all Reform Jews have to be committed to, and stuff like that. So it looks like a manifesto for the New Deal in most cases. So anyway, I think the same is true of really every religion, that there are so many different forms of it. I mean, liberal Islam in Indonesia, Bangladesh, India is very different from the more conservative forms of Islam that you find in many parts of the Arab world. And so it would be hardly recognizable even as the same religion. I just got on my email today an extensive statement about the true meaning of jihad by a leader of the Indian Muslim community, and said, well, everyone who thinks that it has to do with subordinating other religions or struggle against other religions is just violating the deepest spirit of Islam, and it's all about self-perfection and working toward greater moral adequacy. Well, this person is a very deep scholar, and he, but there are different schools of interpretation in Islam. And so this person is not a Wahhabist, obviously. But in any case, he's a great scholar, and there are many things to be said. And of course, what I say as a Reformed Jew uses different principles of interpretation from what my Orthodox friends use also, right? Because my principle of interpretation is, if it's in the Bible and it's something that's unacceptable to my conscience, it's of merely historical interest. Well, on that principle, then you can read things in many different ways. But so what I'm saying is that there's so much internal variation in all the major sects. Again, Hinduism, you could say Hinduism stands for nothing if not for the caste hierarchy, but Gandhi thought Hinduism required the abolition of the caste hierarchy and that its essential commitment was to the pursuit of truth by nonviolent means. And Gandhi was not saying that as a ruse or a political statement. He was a deeply religious person. So I think, in short, there's no end of it if you wanted to say what's the essence of any given sect. They're just different forms of the sect that have emerged over time. And I think you see that most clearly when you don't have religious establishment, because then the more dynamic and younger forms have plenty of chance to spread out. And so, in America, there are feminist forms of this and that. Each week, there's some new splinter group is created. But in many countries where in India, for example, where four religions have been given courts, and this is one reason I'm opposed to religious courts or any kind of delegation of governmental powers to religion, that it ossifies the religion because the power falls into the hands of old men. And so the Christian church in India was one of the most reactionary religious bodies anywhere in the world. Christian women won the right to divorce on grounds of physical cruelty in the year 2001. And the reason was all these male clerics, Catholic and Protestant, had to get together. They all had to be gotten to listen to women, and they had to go to Parliament, and so it took a lot of time. So if they hadn't been established, well, probably they would have gotten it 100 years sooner because they wouldn't have had to deal with the bureaucracy, and women would have just not put up with it. So anyway, I think establishment is very bad for religion as well as being bad for the reasons that I give.
So as an Auslander, it's a little funny to me to come to Deutschland and see that there is religion education in schools, even as someone who was raised in the American Bible Belt. And even though I know we all enjoyed the week off for Pentecost, but why is it called that? I want to hear what you think Europe can do to really give, because we haven't said that. What can Europe do to really give everyone equal treatment of religious, non-religious, etc.?
Well, I think the first thing is just be aware of these issues and be aware that the symbolic domain really is important. It's important because it inflicts psychological harm, but it's more, even if it doesn't, even if people have developed thick skins over the years, it's still is a statement. That's the wrong statement for government to be making. And with the crucifix in Italian classrooms, so many people have said to me, oh, well, but it's just our culture. But believe me, that's not just culture. It's a religious symbol, and it's certainly understood as such by the Jews, the Protestants, and the Muslims, and so on. And so I think that is the first thing, to just keep your eye peeled on the problem and notice it when it arises and then have a debate about it. I think a lot of things will still remain the same because, as I say, holidays, work days off, and so on, those are bound to be arranged to suit the convenience of the majority. But if you're aware that that's what you're doing, then you might be more ready to give a break to the minority when they want some sort of equal dispensation whatever that is. That is, having a different day off or having a different holiday or whatever. And, you know, universities used to just forget about the Jewish holidays when they would schedule their beginning and ending. You know, the most important times of the year would always fall on Yom Kippur or something. Now, in America, they actually, even a private university, which isn't bound to do anything at all, would not do that. And moreover, they would say, you should please announce to your class that if anyone is observing the religious holiday, they have the right to record the lecture and to have a makeup class and so on. So, those are the kinds of things that you can do if you're sensitive to the issue and you recognize it as a problem.